Intervju Radija Študent. Če slabe tri ure se v veliki dvorani kina Šiške pričenja prvi slovenski nastop zasedbe Nicer Ep, ene od pionirskih skupin tako imenovanega EBM žanra, ki je izbruhnil v Evropi na prelomu iz 70-ih v 80-ta leta. Pred tonsko vajo smo se pogovarjali z vsemi tremi člani trenutne postave. To sta vokalist Douglas McCarty in programer ter basist Bon Harris, v novejši inkarnaciji pa se jima je pridružil tudi bobnar Jason Payne. Zasedba Nicer Ep je namreč prenehala z delovanjem leta 1995 in se ponovno zbrala pred 4 leti. Nedavno in po 15 letih je luč sveta ugledala njihova šesta studijska plošča, naslovljena Industrial Complex, kateri je posvečena aktualna turneja. Prihajajo torej Nicer Ep.
With me here are all three members of Nicer Ep or Nicer Ep. What is the pronunciation exactly to start with that?
We started it with the pronunciation of Nicer Ep, but over the years it's probably around 50-50 with the audience who says Nicer and Nicer, and to be honest, it doesn't really bother us either way. It's out for interpretation.
So you've been on tour. How is it going till now? I mean, you have your headline tour right now.
Yeah, we started off in January. Doing some shows opening for Depeche Mode, and you know, in between some of those shows we were doing our own headliners, and now Depeche have finished their tour and we're just into doing our own shows, and all around it's been fantastic. I mean, the response we've had everywhere has been really good. Our headliner shows are always a lot more sort of intense, a lot more intimate, and kind of feels a lot more, you know, real and down to earth, and then and then, you know, when we're doing our own headline, when we're doing the Depeche shows, I mean, it's the vast arenas and huge audiences, and not a big percentage of the audience knows who we are. So that's more of a challenge to try and convince people. It's more like the early days of being in a band where you had to sort of prove and prove your worth. And so it's been good.
Is it enjoyable to do that? Yeah, when you see that you can turn a crowd around, you know, people that maybe haven't even heard the electronic music in the way that we play it, have only sort of known the kind of, you know, the more poppier side like Depeche, and it's interesting to see how they respond finally as the show goes.
But I would say you originated from the same time as Depeche Mode.
A little bit afterwards. We certainly, because we grew up in a town not too far from Basildon where they're from, we grew up in Chelmsford, and so we certainly remember them starting, but they're, I guess they're about 4 years older than us, maybe 5 years older.
5 years ahead of us.
So they were, you know, that much ahead. Although we did start when we were very young. So I think, like, we first recorded a demo tape in 1982. So I guess in terms of, like, actually making music, they were probably only 2 or 3 years ahead of us.
Yeah, maybe.
You said you started in 82. You kind of split, but not really, in 95 or 96. So you started the tour in 2006 again, without having a record. So what was the reason to start the tour?
I'd been playing with Terence Fixmer as Fixmer McCarthy, and our booking agent, Petty, had been getting some requests for Nicer Ep, obviously knowing that I was the singer. And then it got to the point where there was some sort of kind of, you know, quite appealing offers being made, not just because it's, you know, from the financial point of view, but it was like kind of cool places to play, large festivals and headlining. So I spoke with Bon and we got together, happened to be in Chicago where Bon was working on a project at the time. And we just kind of talked through the possibilities of trying out these few shows as they were then. And it soon developed into much more of a significant tour, and we ended up with some gaps in between, touring for 7 months, doing something like 75 shows or something. We ended up doing all over Europe and Japan, Australia, New Zealand, North America, South America, back to Europe. So it kind of just snowballed into this thing that grew out of its own sort of intensity from the expectations from our old audience and a new audience who'd never seen us. So it wasn't as though we were, you know, forced into doing it, but it certainly was almost beyond our control. I mean, we could have stepped off any time, but it was not really planned ahead that much. It just kind of developed and grew kind of organically.
But how do people react? I mean, after, I would say, 10 years you came back. I mean, what was the audience? You mentioned the older generations and the new fans. What was the structure of the audience for the first tour, or even now?
All the way through, it's been a real mixture, because obviously when you've been away for that long, there's your older fans that like miss it and wish that you'd carry on. But there's a whole new generation of people that have been introduced to the music, a lot of younger kids who have never seen it. So in their, you know, in their experience, all they've got is stories from people that were there, photographs, archive material. So I think they were extremely excited that, because they didn't think they would ever see it, you know. So, you know, the audiences are really mixed. You know, there's a lot of older fans that are coming back, but we're really pleasantly surprised about the amount of newer, younger fans, in some cases young kids that are really into it. You know, it's a really good mixture.
So could we say that younger fans are coming, I mean, from the scene, they're listening to the bands you were influencing, like Nine Inch Nails, like Ministry and all this industrial scene. I mean, is this like visible in the shows?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different cross references. People are coming at it from all kinds of different angles. You know, obviously there are a lot of scene kids, but there are some people that just love electronic music. There are some people that, you know, were like fans of Depeche Mode and then progressively got more underground as they went on. So there's a really good mixture of you know, backgrounds and interest in the audience in general.
So you, like I said, somehow split it in 95, but you stayed in music business, I would say, all the time. What were you doing? You mentioned the collaboration with the French DJ producer.
I did that eventually. Initially, then I did some another couple of tracks with Alan Wilder for his Recoil project, and then I decided to go actually back into school and started studying initially graphic design, and then went on to be into film. And when I graduated from university, then I started working in the film industry in London, and I was there was a kind of art group, a production company called Tomato that I was signed to, who you know, they did all the artwork and videos for Underworld. So I was directing for them, and then also working as an assistant director on commercials, and then started getting back into music via Terrence, who invited me to sing initially just on a couple of tracks on an album he was working on, and then we had such a kind of good time in the studio that we just carried on writing, and we ended up with a whole album's worth of music. So that's when we decided to name it something separate from just Terrence Fixman, and Fixman McCarthy was brought about. And, you know, I've done a few other collaborations down the line with another English band, Client, and Clock.
So what were you doing? I mean, in the meantime, I heard that you were like the producer.
Yeah, I went into doing some production in Los Angeles, co-produced one of Marilyn Manson's albums, and worked with him for a couple of years, actually. Then worked a little bit with the Smashing Pumpkins and then went on to co-produce Billy Corgan's solo album. And in the meantime, was doing synthesizers for a lot of bands in LA. Bush, Avril Lavigne, Evanescence, loads of bands, you know, just doing tracks here and there. Cheap Trick was another one. I formed a project of my own called Maven, which we produced one album. And I went back to school to study composition and orchestration, you know, for a large orchestral body, and did some scoring for film and TV in the meantime. So, you know, I pretty much stayed in music. Not a lot of performing in those years. A few shows with Maven, but most of it was studio and composing work.
So we're gonna go back to this work after the tour, after the records, or you will stay in the scene? I mean, this is more general question now. Your intention to how to go on? I mean, you recorded now the sixth or I think record, Industrial Complex.
We found a really good working method on Industrial Complex where we found what really fits for Knights of Ebb, and all of us are creating all the time. So, you know, you can take a part of that creation and look at it and say, okay, that's suitable for Knights of Ebb, you know, and maybe some things aren't, so you go and take those in a different direction. But, you know, we're creative people, and so a part of that, you know, it is going to be channeled into Knights of Ebb and keep it going, because we've found such a good working relationship on this, and there's so many possibilities. I mean, just, you know, doing this tour, you can see the possibilities that could come out of this. So whilst we're enjoying it and the process is fruitful, it would be a shame not to carry on with it. So you know, we're enthusiastic about doing it.
Yeah, sorry, Jason. Yes, you're the drummer on the Big Hit album in '95. So, what was your, I would say, story in between these years? I mean, not playing with Knights of Ebb.
Yeah, I just continued playing music with various other projects and got into doing sound design for commercials, live theater, some film work, and just, you know, continued playing music, mainly drums and percussion. Yeah, but again, getting into some sound design. So
in the early 90s, I mean, a lot of so-called EBM bands started to play more aggressive guitar sound, and also Knights of Ebb went to this direction. Also the Croups, also Front 242. Where did it came to this change of the sound? Because you started, also the Croups started as an electronic band.
I think a lot of the reasonings for including live instrumentation such as guitars wasn't necessarily because of the actual sound of them. It was more the flexibility of them at that time. Technology just wasn't advanced enough to really aid what we wanted to do and express as easily what we want to do. You know, at that point you had to, you know, you'd have an idea. You could work it out maybe on a guitar, and then it would take you days to make it sound not as good as it sounded on a guitar. So I think there's you know, a certain amount of our frustration of the interaction, having to wait between having an idea and it actually coming to fruition was very frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, electronic music, you know, in both in the studio and live, there's a certain amount of, you know, getting through the instruments that you have to do. You know, it's much less emotional than playing a piano or picking up a guitar. It's almost a bit more of an intellectual exercise, getting a synth to sound emotional. And again, once you've done that on a stage, you know, say some of the faster electronic songs, there's no really sensible human way to play that. It has to be a backing track, and sometimes it can be a bit restricting, and I think a lot of electronic bands go through that, where you just want a little bit of freedom, and you don't want everything to be such an intellectual exercise or to take so long. You just want to be able to go to an instrument and express how you're feeling without having to do all these calculations, you know. So I think it's a natural phase for a lot of electronic bands to go through, because making electronic music, it's hard work. A lot of people sort of think it's the easy way out. But many times it isn't. If you're doing something of any value and thinking about it, it's kind of like animation or something. It's a really time-consuming process.
But you actually picked up the instruments, I mean, guitar, bass guitar, yeah. Start playing in the early 90s. What about now? I mean, the industrial complex record sounds a little bit more electronic again for me. What was the reason?
We made a decision before we went in the studio that we would try and stick to our guns of using pure electronics. We didn't, a lot of the songs started with either like Bon playing a piano part or a guitar part was, you know, bass on the bass or a guitar. But we knew that was just, you know, to germinate the idea. We were pretty adamant that it was going to be an electronic sound.
I think a lot of that has to do with our experiences in that 10-year break as well, where we all went off and did our own projects. And that takes a lot of pressure off. You know that, like, if you want to do like a completely fluid guitar record, you can just go and do that as another project. You don't have to kind of force Knights of Ebb to be everything to everybody. You can just say, okay, it seems like this is what Knights of Ebb communicates the best and how it fits the best. So let's not force it to be anything else. You know, just let it be what it wants to be and what a lot of the fans want it to be. But within that, we also found a much more organic and sort of expressive way of making that record. So I think a lot of it was just the culmination of the experiences we'd had and just the relaxation to just let it be what it naturally wants to be at that point.
And what was the process in the studio? What is the process of recording, like, the new record, which is more or less electronic, but you're acting live like a band somehow?
The approach we took on this one is we gathered together most days really without a preset idea or without, you know, sort of trying to put too many preconceptions, and we just started playing. It might be, I've got an electronic mallet instrument, like a xylophone, but it's hooked up to a synthesizer, so, you know, maybe it started with a bass line or, like Doug said, with a piano part or a bass. And we'd all just listen to each other, you know, just like an old-fashioned band. We'd listen to what each other was doing, join in. Someone had an idea, you know, Doug would listen, step up to the mic, start singing. And I think because we were all listening to and reacting to each other, so much of it fell into place much more naturally, you know, because rather than all sitting in our bedrooms emailing each other files, you know, not only could we hear what's going on, but we felt each other's energy and the mood. And that affected everything. So we kept it very loose like that, where we'd go in, we'd say, okay, we're going to play slowly, you know. So we'd play slowly. And if after an hour we had something, we'd carry on with that. And if not, we'd take a break, come back and say, okay, now we'll play fast, you know, and try something different. But most of the time, because it was such a natural process, we got something very quickly.
But it took some time to make this record, because you started, I think, soon after the world tour you were making.
Yeah, it didn't actually. I mean, we definitely had a very relaxed approach to going in the studio. You know, we like Bon said, we wanted it to be a non-pressured situation. We were lucky enough to have a very big space, pretty much lent to us by a friend of ours, the structure, the timing structure of our day there was deliberately limited, and partly because of it, we were borrowing the space. So we would start the day around noon and end the day around 6-7. Sometimes we'd go as late as maybe 8 o'clock. But basically, it was a very kind of easygoing day. We'd only work for the most part 5 days a week all together. And then as time went on, then individually, obviously, whenever you're in the studio, even if you're doing 18-hour days, 7 days a week, which unfortunately we have done, even at that point, when you get out of the studio, you're still thinking about the songs, you're still writing stuff, you know, continually. Mm-hmm. So there was obviously work being done by Jason, myself and Bon when we left the studio, but every day, Monday to Friday, we'd get in together. So from that point of view, maybe it added some time to the recording process. The other thing was, we had to literally stop ourselves writing songs. We got to just over 30 tracks when we figured. figured we probably should stop and assess what we had. We would go into the studio, like Bon said, and you know, have a general kind of like, let's play a slow song or a fast song, or let's try and do a groove song, whatever. And then generally we'd have something by the end of that day or by the end of the next day. And then as soon as it got to a level where we knew we could put it to bed and listen to it again in like a week or a month, and we'd know where we were, you know, there was enough information recorded that we would realize and remember what it was. Generally, we did put those tracks to bed. So we just kept on moving until we had this quite large body of work. And then we chose which ones were not necessarily less good, but which ones were more applicable to the overall sound that we were applying to the, to, mm-hmm. to the album. So I think probably that process took a year in total, like the recording and then eventual mixing. There were gaps in between because we were coming out to do shows and other things were going on. But we then, having finished it, had the unenviable task of trying to figure out how to release it. You know, the record industry is basically non-existent. Yeah, we had the unenviable task of figuring out how to release a record when the record industry virtually didn't exist. So we went through lots of ideas with lots of different people, some of whom aren't working in the music industry anymore. You know, it's a really tough mm-hmm. tough place to be. So that took probably as long, if not longer, than making the record itself, was how to release it, how to, you know, which delivery vehicle do you, you know, system do you use to get it out to the public.
In the meantime, from 95 till now, I mean, a lot of things happened in electronic music. Were you influenced by any of these things? I mean, any of these DJs, producers, bands coming from electronic scene?
In the 10 years gap that we had, I actually didn't listen to a lot of electronic music. You know, it's just like mostly the projects that I've been working on. Obviously, I was aware of, you know, the DJ culture and the impact that's having, and certain DJs I would hear now and again. But I think probably to a benefit in my point of view, from my personal standpoint, I didn't listen to a lot, so it was much fresher for me to make electronic music when I came back, mm-hmm. you know, and wasn't actually too influenced by anything going on.
So, for tonight's show, what yes. are we going to hear? I mean, what are you playing? Are you promoting more or less new record, or do you play also older songs? What is the setup?
Well, we play a really good mixture of both. We're constantly adding new tracks from the new record, but then also reintroducing very, very old tracks. And it's about maybe half and half.
Yeah.
Something like that. So it's like, you know, a good representation of all the previous records, plus a lot from the new record. And, you know, a lot of old fans will be really happy with some of the really old tracks that we're going to be playing.